From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello, I'm Caroline Hugg and welcome to The Wealth Show. Today I'm at Citywire's Wealth Manager Conference with Helen Lewis, British journalist and former deputy editor of The New Statesman. Helen's just given a really fascinating talk on the need for chaos voters in politics. Could you explain this concept?
Yeah, there's a really interesting finding in political science research. About 1 in 3 people agree with statements such as, you know, I just find politics boring and I wish it was a bit more chaotic. You know, I think the system has failed. We need to tear it all down and start again. You know, these quite, well, you would have in a previous time said quite revolutionary statements. And yet when you look around politics in the West, it has actually been marked by a lack of political violence, particularly in historical terms. You know, that's not to say that there haven't been isolated outbreaks, but when you look at what politics kind of used to be like, it has been relatively, not exactly calm, but certainly less violent than it used to be, less revolutionary than it used to be. But what you do see is people who want to mix it up a bit. And those types of voters are interesting because they can come from very different demographics. So you see that kind, those kind of statements made by perhaps young black men in the context of police racism, you know, the riots after the murder of George Floyd, people who don't feel that there's, you know, there's any investment in the system for them. You also see them among older, educated, affluent white men who have experienced what they feel as a kind of loss of status in the last 50 years. You know, they feel that the world isn't quite what they kind of expect it would be, what they feel they haven't got really what they feel that they deserve. And they also would like to just tear the system down and start again. And those voters are really interesting because everything we thought we knew in political science said that if you are older, you're richer, you're more embedded in your community, you're married, you've got kids, you've got a job, you know, you should have an investment in the system that makes you not want a revolution, right? Classically, yeah. Revolutions are, you know, young guys in coffee shops who feel they haven't got a lot to lose. And we've now seen the emergence of these chaos voters who are semi-revolutionary in their tendencies, but you think wouldn't want a full-bore revolution. And January 6th, the insurrection at the Capitol in the US in 2021, I think those were a good example. The guy with the horns, he's a chaos voter, right? He doesn't necessarily want a completely new system of government. He wants to still drive a car and live in America and do all those kind of things that American prosperity has delivered. But he also wants excitement in his life. And politics has kind of failed for those people to deliver the kind of excitement that they want.
So why are we seeing a global rise in populism? Obviously, we have the rise in popularity of right-wing leaders in Ireland, more recently in Portugal. We have Meloni, for example, in Italy. So why are we seeing this trend?
Well, I think you can look at it in two ways, and one of them is about kind of values, and one of them is about the underlying economic conditions. Now, if you look at somewhere like Italy, you know, Italy is on the border of the Mediterranean. It has seen large numbers of migrants from Africa, which is a trend that we'll only expect to increase as climate change really bites and more of the world becomes uninhabitable. And people do experience mass migration as threatening. I think, you know, politicians have to acknowledge that. It's not necessarily the places in Britain with the most migration that are most likely to vote for populist parties or most likely to vote for Brexit. The places that were most likely to vote for Brexit were the places that seen the most rapid change. And that's what people really feel quite alarmed about. And what populism often offers are a set of very clear solutions and propositions, and often embodied in the person of one really charismatic leader. So they make politics simple and appealing in a way that the kind of noisy cacophony of much more managerial politics simply can't deliver.
We haven't mentioned Trump yet.
I think by law we have to, yes.
So what could a potential Trump victory mean for this kind of rise in populism? Should we be worried?
I mean, I think we should. The Atlantic has been very kind of clear that it sees Trump as a threat to American democracy. And that's based on the statements that he himself has made. You know, he said he wants to be a dictator from day one. He said that he wants, for example, full immunity from prosecution. Now, there is obviously a bit of self-interest there, as he's currently facing a lot of prosecutions. But there has been a, you know, a rule in America and elsewhere that politicians aren't exempt from legal scrutiny. Actually, just in this parliament alone, I think we've had like maybe 5 MPs who've been convicted of various criminal offences, you know, these things like driving offences to more serious sexual offences. But the idea is that politicians shouldn't be above the law. That's a really important democratic restraint. Not something that Trump really agrees with. You know, he kind of believes if the president does it, it's legal, right? So that's really worrying. He also wants, in part of his kind of crusade against what he calls the deep state, he wants to force out huge numbers of officials and replace them with political appointees, which moves you much more to a kind of patronage system, the kind of thing we're much more used to seeing in developing countries that are more chaotic. You know, the idea that if you want to have a job in government, you have to be, you know, you have to agree with the leader, that everything is dependent on his kind of patronage. So those are some of the ways, I think, in which Trump is a real challenge to democracy. Never mind the fact that one of the cases he's facing in Georgia is about him phoning up the Attorney General and saying, could you, you know, find me some votes, please?
Wow.
You know, so there are really serious questions about his commitment to democracy. I think it's really telling that in 2016, when he won, Hillary Clinton, who lost to him, and Barack Obama, the previous president, they both turned up at his inauguration, right? They both made a big show of, this isn't the outcome we wanted, but we believe in the peaceful transfer of power. When the same thing happened to Trump, and when he lost the election in 2020, he didn't go to the inauguration. He flew off in a slight huff. And skipped it, and has spent the time since saying, well, actually, I really lose it. So he by definition, he felt that because he lost, it was illegitimate. The election was illegitimate. That stuff is just really corrosive, you know, and it's something in Britain that we just haven't really seen on that same basis. You know, Liz Truss might not have liked only getting 44 days as Prime Minister, but she left. She didn't barricade herself inside Downing Street.
On that note, so what's happening in the UK? Because, you know, will a Labour victory break this mould or, sorry, trend that we've been seeing? And is the UK post-chaos?
I would love to think that the UK was post-chaos, but I think, for a start, I think a certain amount of dynamism, which is the low-level version of chaos, is necessary in any political system, you know? We don't want a situation like Russia in which one guy is in charge and gets to stay in charge and there's nothing anyone else can really do about that. So, you know, you need a kind of engine of change in democracies to renew them. That's fine. That said, I think if Keir Starmer gets in, what you will see is a left-wing movement against him. Like, I am old enough to have lived through the Tony Blair years. And even before the Iraq War, which I think made lots of people very critical of Labour's foreign policy, there were other criticisms of him that he, you know, for example, had brought private finance initiatives into the public sector in order to get things built. He was using private money. That he had introduced more kind of marketisation reforms into the NHS. So, you know, for all the Tories, we've seen them being, you know, having problems on their right flank, over perhaps, you know, their attitude to the Rwanda flights, deporting people to Rwanda, or other kind of asylum and immigration issues, you will see a mirror image of that. And if we get a Labour government, there will be people who are very unhappy that the Labour government isn't as left-wing as they thought it would be. You certainly see at the moment huge problems for Keir Starmer over Labour's position on a ceasefire in Gaza. And he started off by saying, you know, Israel has an absolute right to defend itself after the October 7th terrorist attack. And he has moved ever since, as that death toll has just gone up and up and up and up, to facing more and more pressure to people to say, why isn't Labour standing against this? Why isn't Labour calling for a ceasefire? And, you know, that was part of the reason he went to talk to the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, in Parliament and said, you know, I really want to be able to give Labour members of Parliament the opportunity to vote on a motion that has the word ceasefire in it, because they're being followed home, you know, they're facing threats and intimidation. So that stuff is not going to go away. And in fact, I would say under a Labour government, because they're the ones in power, they can actually do something, it will intensify and amplify.
What about the opposition to the Labour Party in the shape of Nigel Farage, for example? Do you think that his return to politics could mean anything?
Well, I think he's a very individually popular figure. He's quite a divisive one, but within the kind of his caucus, he's really popular. He's a very incredibly engaging speaker. You know, he's a brilliant performer of politics. His persona is incredibly well crafted. And because he hasn't actually been, you know, in government, unlike someone like Boris Johnson, who the country found very entertaining up until the moment he was actually in number 10, at which point this, you know, went quite sour on him quite quickly.
Yeah.
Nigel Farage hasn't been through that kind of process. So, you know, if he came back and really became heavily involved in reform. He's obviously got a stake in it, but if he became the front man of that in the way that he was so heavily involved in British politics during the Brexit era, that is a real challenge to the Conservatives. Now, the way that first past the post works makes it very hard for new parties to get any MPs. You have to really break through in a single constituency. It's very hard. But, you know, if you get constituencies where 1,000 or 5,000 voters switch from Conservatives to Reform, or even from Labour to Reform, that makes those seats a lot harder to predict.
You know, if we're going on this theme of chaos, some far-right politics and voters may swing to the right when they're confronted with chaotic headlines in the press. So do you think journalists have a role to play in amplifying chaos and turning political sentiment, especially when considering the role of GB News or Talk TV?
Yeah, I think one of the things I think is very interesting about GB News is it has been an enormous money loser. And so if it continues to operate, the big question there'll be is, what are the people behind it paying for, you know? And then if you look at the sheer number of Conservative MPs that it employs, there is a kind of say that, well, maybe it makes sense to them because they're paying essentially for influence and access. You know, they're paying to have this voice in British politics. They're not actually paying to run a kind of cutthroat commercial operation. So, you know, when you look at it through that lens, it's not surprising that there are, you know, huge discussions of, I know, sorry, this word is very triggering to some people, but, you know, the woke wars. Because that stuff is very energising for a lot of voters. Yeah. You know, they really hate the feeling that the left is sort of super censorious and tells you what you can and can't say and is all perpetually offended. So, you know, that kind of rhetoric is really energising and popular. So you will definitely see that continue. The trouble is that journalism is about things that are new and things that are bad. People don't want to hear about things that are old and good. You know, that's, you know, what's the Tolstoy phrase? You know, all unhappy families are unhappy in their own ways. You know, happy families are all alike. And it's sort of, there is a similar thing. It's just, you know, things working as they should is quite boring. So journalism always focuses on negativity. And frankly, that's what gets people clicking. So I think that's something that you just have to kind of navigate around. I mean, the big problem I would say now is that, you know, we just have this huge glut of information, often very low quality, you know, that is written off, for example, search engine optimization. Lots of people are Googling what's wrong with Kate Middleton. And so that article springs up, or 500 articles spring up to deal with that question.
Yeah.
So the kind of, although it was very undemocratic in some ways, the idea that you had gatekeepers of news information even 20 years ago who told people what they should be interested in, now you really get to see what people are actually interested in from the kind of from the bottom up. And that does mean that, you know, the kind of improving porridge is even less appealing than it ever was.
What about the role of AI? What is AI going to mean for the election year?
Well, I think the AI might very well be used for deep fakes. You know, we have seen a couple of versions of them already, fake clips of Keir Starmer, for example. And over in the US, we saw a faked AI image of Donald Trump. We've seen fake robocalls, which are the kind of, you know, AI-generated calls to voters that they pick up your landline and you get. So there are, you know, even in super low-tech ways, you know, they have just made spreading misinformation just a lot easier. You know, there are lots of other things. I mean, AI might change politics really profoundly if it hollows out, for example, coding jobs. You know, the kind of things that have been quite high-status, good jobs, in an intellectual sense, might get automated in the way that manufacturing jobs did in the 20th century. And, you know, you used to have a car plant that employed thousands upon thousands of people sewing the seats. Now it's much more robotic, and there's, you know, one man or woman who is in charge of managing those machines. That tendency that happened for manufacturing jobs, that could happen to intellectual jobs too, at which point you are looking at a really great reordering of the job market and a knock-on effect on society.
So the Financial Times wrote a piece recently which I found really interesting on the Gen Z gender divide when it comes to politics. So while younger men are appearing to be more conservative, younger women are more liberal or more left-leaning. Why has this trend come about, and could this pose a problem in the future?
Yeah, I saw a great tweet that was like, you know, the thing is, there's a really great opportunity for women to become more conservative and then they'll be able to date more men. And you're like, hang on a minute, by that taken, there's also a great opportunity for men to become more liberal and then they're going to do better on the dating market. I think one of the things that's interesting, and, you know, I say this as somebody who probably does self-define as liberal, is it's associated with higher neuroticism. higher anxiety, and actually also generationally, Gen Z women are much more anxious than Gen Z men. So in a way, that sort of weird quirk of temperament and ideology makes sense. I think also, if you think about the messages that we've given to men in the last 10 years, there has been a lot about, quote-unquote, male privilege. Mm. I'm not sure if you're a 17-year-old boy, you particularly feel you've got a lot of male privilege, right? You will probably feel a bit insecure, a bit worried that if you try and talk to girls, they might be rude to you, mock you. You don't, you know, you're not a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. You're just somebody who's trying to get by. And so I think that lots of young men have kind of felt like, this doesn't describe me. You know, this world in which men have all the power and women don't, in their relationships with girls their own age, they just don't feel that connects with them. And that, I think, makes them, you know, very, not easy prey, because I don't think it's a completely ridiculous thing to say, but it makes them very primed for listening to some of those messages from people like Andrew Tate. The other thing is, you know, if we look at women's progress during the 20th century, women have been trading up. Why do women want to go into the workforce? It's because having economic independence gives you a huge number of options. It means you can leave the bad marriage. It means you can move the city. It means you don't have to stay at home and look after your parents. It gives you freedom and opportunity. And what is the bargain that men have got through that time? It's that, would you like to do more washing up? You know, would you like to do more unpaid childcare that we all agree is really, you know, difficult to juggle with a career? So there hasn't been, like, these gains for women have, to some extent, I have to say, been a little bit zero sum. Sometimes, you know, I think often equality improves life for everybody. But there are, I think, men who will feel that they have lost out from this new bargain. And so some of that conservatism among young men is maybe a kind of nostalgia. And a nostalgia that's been fed to them by influencers. You said, wouldn't it have been great to be in your granddad's generation when you'd have had a wife who would have done what you wanted? You would have made all the decisions in the household. You would have earned the money. You would have been the king of your own little world. And I think that's to a young guy who's feeling lost and confused, that is a really appealing message.
But do you think that this will change in the future? Their sentiment will change? Or might this pose a problem towards the, like, wider attitudes towards feminism in the future?
I think we're definitely living through a period of backlash to feminism. But the story is one of incredible gains. You know, I wrote Difficult Women in 2020, and at that point we were looking at, you know, 150 years since of women being allowed to go to university. The vote in 1918 here in Britain, Equal Pay Act in the 1970s, sex discrimination legislation again in the 1970s. These are quite recent. Within my mother's lifetime, you know, that it was legal to pay a woman less for a job, you know, sack her for getting pregnant, all of those kind of things. So I think you have to sometimes step back and take a bit of a historical view. But I would say the 2010s, through things like the Me Too movement, there was a push onwards, and now the tide has kind of come back out again a bit.
All right, on that slightly pessimistic note.
My talk today ended on a slightly pessimistic note of, yes, global chaos and confusion. The other thing I said in the talk today was, you know, if you look at the musical Hamilton, you know, Aaron Burr, he was vice president of the USA at a time when he shot a fellow politician. We are not living through unprecedentedly chaotic or violent times. It can feel the world's very confusing. And part of that is purely access to news constantly all of the time. And one of the things that I think, you know, I sure will appeal to people listening to this podcast is about seeking out high quality sources of information and trying to tune out some of the noise. Because if you want to, you can freak yourself out about all the terrible things that are happening that you have no control over. But
Become a chaos voter.
Well, you might become a chaos voter. But, or you might just say, well, at least, I mean, part of the chaos voter thing is about agency and control. It's like, if there's going to be chaos, I want to be in control of it. I want to feel like I'm riding the dragon rather than the dragon is coming towards me and the flame is, you know, kind of licking at my feet. But, you know, this is, particularly as we're talking just before International Women's Day, as a woman, there has never been a better time to be alive in terms of healthcare, in terms of access to the job market, in terms of self-actualization. You know, we are lucky in that sense. And even when it can feel very chaotic, it's worth remembering that.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Alan.
Thank you.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.